Hello, everybody. It's me, the Vern. I just wanted to let you all know that Cinema Recall does have a Patreon page. This is the place where you can get bonus episodes as well as suggest topics for upcoming episodes. And you can find that all at patreon.com/cinemarecall. I really appreciate you checking it out, and I hope you enjoy this week's episode.
This podcast is a proud member of the That Moment In Podcast Network. Check out the network at thatmomentin.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this another episode of the Cinema Recall podcast over at thatmomentin.com. I'm your host, The Vern, and I am extremely excited to have on here two wonderful authors we have with us right now. Scott Nolan, who wrote the book Bargain Bin Reviews. Hello, Scott.
Oh, yeah, that's my cue. I am Nolan, and yes, thank you. As the Vern just told you, I wrote The Bargain Bin Review, which you can find under my other name, Scott Nolan, which my parents insist on calling me. That is out there. I don't know how much of a spiel we want me to go into now, but that is out there on Amazon. You can go to that site if you've heard of that site. That's Amazon.com, and search for The Bargain Bin Review by Scott Nolan. It is a collection of 90 handcrafted artisanal reviews of bad movies, selected special for you. And do you want me to keep going?
No, that's it right there. I appreciate that, man.
Okay.
And we have also with us Mike Vaughn, who wrote the book The Ultimate Guide to Strange Cinema. Thank you very much, Mike.
Hey, like Scott, my book's on Amazon. It's over 300 reviews of just crazy, weird, out there cinema from all different genres, comedy, action, you name it.
Yeah, I like the fact, too, how you both separate each of your movies into different – you got the genres right there, too. But Mike, your book even goes into like regions as well, like books from other, like movies from other countries, which I find very fascinating. And I find Scott's books also fascinating because he also separates his books into different genres. He does a section all about movies you see on Mystery Science Theater 3000, as well as movies about kaiju monsters. And I like the way that you both separate your movies out there, which is a lot of fun. Mainly I wanted to get you both on this episode here is because I think it's difficult to establish what a cult movie is now today versus what it was back in the early days. And I just want to get your opinions about this because you have both wrote Ultimate Guides to Cult Cinemas, and I just wanted to get your feedback about this topic. What do you consider to be, you know, cult films nowadays? Because to me, I don't know if there really is such ones. And then I want to get into a conversation about what you think are overrated and underrated cult films. But listening to a topic right now about like streaming media, do you think that streaming media helps or hinders a cult film? And just kind of jump in.
I mean, I think it absolutely helps. I mean, I think with the accessibility of films now, that kind of coupled with social media, you know, you can get a word of mouth or a buzz about a film unlike any other time in history, really. So I think it actually, you know, I think the potential to have a cult film or something like a smaller film with a wider selective audience is kind of more how do I say, like more you have the ability to do that more with, you know, everything just being kind of out there.
Yeah, and I would absolutely agree that if anything, it helps because you have the ability to get that word of – you have all these different avenues to get word of mouth out and build an audience and such. What I think is interesting about this question, this topic, is that I think it forces the question of what is a cult film? Because I know when you initially sent this out to, like, let us know, like, oh, yeah, this is what we want to talk about, my knee-jerk was it doesn't matter in terms of a cult film. And I don't want to get all Merriam-Webster dictionary because then I'd have to start punching myself in the crotch. But what made me think about this was a book that came out a few years ago called 500 Essential Cult Movies, The Ultimate Guide by Jennifer Ellis. Or East. There's no L in her last name. So and it's a good book. I mean, they're very capsule kind of reviews. It's very, but some of what really kind of got my back up a bit was because her definition of a cult film is, and I actually pull it up to go look at it, is one that inspires an almost unhealthy level of devotion in its fans, whether that fan base consists of just 10 people or hundreds of thousands. So her book, in addition to a number of unquestionably awesome and, you know, worthy cult film, you know, movies that you would think of as a cult film, a cult movie, her book also features such obscure films as, and stop me if I'm mispronouncing any of these, Star Wars. And Taxi Driver.
I don't think I heard this before.
Goodfellas. Not Fellers, Fellas. And The Wizard of Oz. And so I'm going through this book and I'm like, what the hell? These are not, in my mind, these are not cult films. And so as I was, because I've been just as background for people who don't know or haven't been, like, I've been, you know, covering bad movies for a long time. I'm co-host of The Layer of the Unwanted with Jason Soto. It's a podcast now in its ninth year, and we look at, you know, bad movies and stuff. So obviously it's something that I've thought a lot about. I imagine Mike has too. And I've ultimately kind of come down to thinking of a cult film is any film, and really, you get a cult blank, so a cult TV show would be a cult, you know, but for their purposes, a film that was initially unsuccessful, and you can define on what success is. Is it poor box office? Is it a lack of distribution? Whatever. That has amassed a devoted fan base over time. So in my mind, so you could make arguments like, okay, so Star Wars is not a cult film in my mind. It was a huge success by any metric, you know. But you could make the argument that Heaven's Gate is a cult film. I don't know that I would, but you could. You know what I'm saying? So that's kind of where I settled on. I don't know what you guys throw that out there for thoughts, but that's why I thought it was interesting with the streaming. I'm like, well, you know what? It may not matter. It may change the metrics of what is considered a successful film if the film is, say, initially put out on Netflix, you know, so there's no box office, and that's the distribution, but there's no number, so who knows, you know, maybe 10 years from now, the Cloverfield Paradox becomes a cult film because people – love, you know, there's an audience of people who absolutely love it despite the fact that it's not good, you know.
Yeah.
But there's no, without having to point at, like, oh, it was a box office bomb, or oh, it came out and the critics hated it and everyone hated it, or just, you know, or kind of some of what I think we would probably, or kind of some of our knee jerks, like our Plan 9s of Outer Space or The Room, where, like, there's no distribution and it gets this kind of weird word of mouth thing going, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I feel like it's any movie that was not particularly well received, but fans kind of take it back and say, you know, I do like this, you know, that to me is. I mean, when you put out the topic, what we were going to talk about with cult cinema, it's it's like you said, it's very tricky because there's different – people have different definitions of what a cult film is. But, I mean, Sky, you and I's definition kind of is exactly the same.
I would say so, yeah.
Yeah. Well, here's the two. I mean, I remember even back in the like early 90s or so, probably like late 80s, early 90s, even Star Wars was almost a cult film because it was a movie that was really popular in the 70s. And then when it came to like the 80s, I see it like mentioned in movies like Clerks. And then it wasn't as big as it is now. There was like a time between after when the movies were released. I think after like the special editions came out, Star Wars was almost considered to be a cult film because it was mentioned in like these little indie movies, mentioned in a lot of like independent movies.
Maybe it's an age thing, because I think I'm a fair clip older than you.
Yeah.
Like Star Wars was never not popular. I think it's more that what made movies like Clerks kind of endearing is that they had these, and it's a very Generation X thing to have these very pop culture-y kind of conversations, and that was like a big mark of the generation. But yeah, Star Wars was always, you know, I grew up playing with Star Wars figures, and we'd run around the yard and argue about who got to be Han Solo, because nobody wanted to be Luke Skywalker for whatever reason, and you know. Yeah, and maybe that's just a product of my age, but yeah, there was never a time where it was not. There was a time when it wasn't maybe being constantly talked about in pop culture because there wasn't a film about to come out or just came out or you know, there was that gap of time between, you know, but it was always incredibly popular.
I mean, but do you think it's just a movie that has a large following, or like a movie that has an underground large following?
Well,
I guess.
Oh, it's got a large following, and even the original trilogy.
I meant just like cult films in general.
Oh, cult films. All right, I thought we were still talking about Star Wars. I'm like, I think it may depend on the film. I think if it's a devoted, a very vocal, devoted fan base, you look at something like, and it's not a film, but I think you'll see where I'm going with it. If you look at something like Firefly, that had a very loud, vocal, and still has a very loud, vocal, passionate fan base, not large enough to save it for a second season or to, you know, to really, but it's there. So
yeah, I mean, well, let me ask you this right here. The Rocky Horror Picture Show, do you think the Rocky Horror Picture Show would have its status as being a cult movie without its theatrical run? Because I'm sure the movie would get an audience if it was just online, but I don't know if it would be as big as it was, because I still think that a strong word of mouth theatrical run, it is going to be powerful. I agree that social media definitely does help a movie, but I also think that time has to help with movie as well to achieve that cult status. So I'm just kind of curious if a movie like I said before, the Rocky Horror Picture Show, if would it have that cult status without his theatrical run, or would it?
I don't know that there's one set blueprint to successfully creating a cult film, right? So, as someone who has sat down when I remember, again, I'm showing my age, when Rocky Horror Picture Show first came out on VHS, and it was a big deal that it came out on VHS, and this was before, like, this is before people bought movies for their home library. They just rented them. So, like, if you wanted to buy a copy of Rocky Horror Picture Show on VHS, it cost $90. You know, wrap your head around that.
I remember those days. Yeah.
So I remember getting it and sitting down in my, you know, in the rec room by myself, to watch it and thinking, like, this is painful to sit through, just to sit and watch it. You need that midnight show live audience experience. So I don't, you know, maybe it would have. I think that's a show that definitely got its life from the midnight showings and such. But on the flip side, you've got films like Miami Connection that somebody at what's the theater chain?
The
Alamo. Yeah, like someone at Alamo just like found it dumpster diving or whatever. I don't know where they found it, and it picked up steam and it got this total word of mouth. I mean, to an extent, The Room did the same thing. You know, the guy, you know, Tommy Wiseau had his billboard up in L.A., sure, and he had a couple showings, but it wasn't until, like, you know, some, and I can't remember, I'm blanking, I don't know if it was Slash Films or somebody kind of really grabbed onto it, and, like, you almost had, like, disciples for the film, like, making people watch it and going, like, hold on, you need to see this, and kind of almost like evangelizing for it. So, you know, would it have, if Rocky Horror Picture Show were to come out today versus when it did, well, it would have to take a very different path, and who knows, I guess is my incredibly long, the short version of my incredibly long-winded answer there.
No, it totally makes sense right there. So it seems to me that in order for a cult film to get more and more successful, it has to maybe be founded by, like, a theater chain or some of the forms of distribution, because a lot of independent filmmakers, they're kind of working with their own production companies, and they don't have the big support of the studio systems. I'm kind of curious about how, like, those movies become successful. Troma is a good studio of helping to promote up-and-coming filmmakers, and they even have their own YouTube channel, and they seem to be doing well, but I don't know, like, Troma movies now, I think they have their good, devoted, loyal fans. Yeah. See, a topic like this is difficult to talk about.
That's part of what it's tripping me up, is you're talking about how is a classic, you know, cult film become successful today, and I'm thinking, and I think Mike said that this, I'm thinking the same thing, like, well, a cult film has to fail first.
Yeah, it's true.
Like, in some way, shape, or form, and that failure can take many different shapes. It would not surprise me 5-10 years from now if John Carter was a cult film.
Oh my gosh, yes.
You know what I'm saying? And that, I mean, that got huge. It was a national, you know, nationwide distribution and all that. But yeah, so I think there's a lot of different avenues, and I think some of it is kind of comes. I think there has to be a failure to start in some way, shape, or form, and then it's just a matter of, and it's going to be different with each film. Like, what was that failure?
It seems to me that in order for, like, a cult film to be successful, it's got to go through some time.
Right.
Like, through many years of actually being in theaters, first of all, getting, like, the bad reviews, and then years later, someone will write a review saying that it's misunderstood, and then it'll get picked up again. Because I think that movie talked about the Miami Connection, that was, like, an 87, 88 film.
Right. And here, I think, like, that didn't get distribution at all. I think it was, like, screened once or twice locally and then forgotten about.
Yeah, and then...
with another one, whatchamacallit, Deathbed, The Bed That Eats, was the same way.
Really? Okay.
That was one... Oh, yeah.
Great film, by the way.
Yeah. That was a film... I think the filmmaker forgot he made it. Like... Something he made and got a couple screenings, and then, like, that was it. And probably had lost so much or sunk so much money in it at that point. It just, like, all right, back to the day job. And then it was discovered sometime later. And yeah, famously, the guy had, they reached out to get, like, rights to distribute it and stuff, and he'd forgotten he made it. So, you know.
Well, I think a really good example, though, is Blade Runner, the original Blade Runner. Oh. I mean, it tanked at the box office, yet, I mean, you know, it was years later re-evaluated as a, you know, neo-noir classic. So, I mean, I would consider Blade Runner, you know, even though it's higher budget, I would still consider that like a cult film, since the audience years later kind of recognized that it was a really great film, and they took the fans took it back.
Yeah, Blade Runner.
Yeah,
had
I would agree with that, actually. I think that's spot on.
Blade Runner had a very interesting history because it was first tested with audiences, and this is before they added the narration and the happy ending, and test audiences were not keen on how it ended, so they added in the narration, they added in a happy ending, and that even failed harder than before. So then years later, they took out the narration and the happy ending, and that seemed to get people more and more on board with it, especially in the 90s. And then many years later, they made the ultimate cut, the final cut, and now it was registered into the Library of Congress. But we're talking about from like 82 until about like 94 of when they got registered into the Library of Congress, maybe even later, maybe it was 2000s, I'm not quite sure about the actual dates of that. But yeah, that was, like I said, that was at least, gosh, a good 10, you know, almost like 20 years or so before they actually got a good, before it got, you know, recognized as being the classic film that it is. Yeah, no, Blade Runner's a very good sample there. So I guess in your guys' mind or your opinions, what is the difference between being like a good bad movie versus just a movie that's just bad? All right, there are like tons of really great movies that are bad but they're enjoyable, and then there are movies that are just bad. And I just wanted to get your guys' opinions about that. So, like, what makes a movie a good bad movie?
I mean, honestly, I've thought about this a lot, and I kind of think that there's like for The Room, for example, there's an earnest quality about it. Like, it's so, you know, settled in its convictions that it almost kind of makes it that's kind of what makes part of what makes The Room a good film for me is that, you know, he clearly was very into the project. You know, maybe it has problems, but you can kind of gloss over those because it was made with such a devoted kind of love for the material.
Is that why a movie like Plan 9 from Outer Space has been rated as the best bad movie of all time? Is it because it's made with such passion?
I would say so. And you know, I mean, it is very clear that's a passion project. And I think that's why there's a lot of affection for The Room, because it's very clear that was a very personal, very earnest project. I think the simplest answer is just entertainment value, and then it becomes like, what is it you find entertaining, or you find like this really bad line, like these really bad line deliveries entertaining, or the fact that, like, you know, they're using pie plates on strings for spaceships and, you know, that kind of thing. But the earnestness is a pretty big thing. I know something that comes up is, can something be intentionally bad? And I think it would be interesting to see what Mike says. I think it can. I think that is a much harder kind of needle to thread. I've seen intentionally bad movies be really enjoyable and a lot of fun, but a lot of times it can fail like that's something that can really blow up in your face. And that was the discussion, you know, when you had brought up earnestness and like to that made me think of that. So curious on your thoughts on that one.
Well, it kind of comes back to cult cinema. There was this really interesting thing that I think it was New Line tried to market Mommy Dearest as a cult film, and it backfired, of course, because, you know, it's one of those things that has to be organic. Like, you know, it's hard to say if you make an intentionally bad movie or like a so bad it's good movie that it's necessarily going to work, because it's one of those things that it's a difficult formula. You just can't package it like that and assume that it's going to have that effect, because like I said, they try to do that with Mommy Dearest, with being an automatic cult film, and it didn't work. But, you know, I mean, eventually it did find its cult status. But, you know, my point though is it's something that has to be, the fans have to, you know, give you that. It's not something you can just manufacture.
Yeah, you just can't lay claim to it. It's gotta, right.
Gotcha. And also, too, I think there also needs to be, like, this is what I find difficult, especially the ages of streaming media. I might go see a movie and think it's really good, and my friends might like it, and we don't know actually how to get that movie out there to people. And you're talking about the movie The Room earlier, and I think The Room benefited to being successful of having Tom Wiseau go put up those billboards and having theatrical screenings in the LA area, and then it got picked up. I don't know, does The Room actually have a DVD release for it? I mean, was it?
Yes.
It does?
Yeah.
Okay.
It even has a Blu-ray, actually.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, because here's the thing, too. I don't really see this movie in stores. And I know that's kind of hit on to like a little nerve there, because there's not really much video stores anymore. But I live in the Midwest, and the only type of video stores we have are like Targets and Walmarts. And I never find that movie there. We even have a store called Best Buy. And I rarely see cult movies. Now, I know there's a distributor called like Vestron Video that's putting out older movies. And gosh, I'm just trying to think right now of the stuff that they do. But they're putting out special editions of movies out right now. And same thing like Shout Factory. They're also putting out a series of movies. I'm just kind of blanking on certain names right now. And I think that's a good thing. But with movies like The Room, I still think it still benefits from having theatrical screenings, because I don't recall there being a Room Facebook group or even like a Twitter account for The Room. I've never really even heard of The Room until I heard it mentioned on the Letter of the Unwanted podcast when you guys did like your first script read.
Yep.
For that one there. I've never really heard this movie before, but you guys were just touting this movie off. And your co-host Jason Soto was kind of praising this movie being on the air. I know, I think they played part of it on what's that network here, Cartoon Network, as an April Fool's joke. I think they did. But I'm just kind of fascinated by the whole thing here, because here's a movie that this guy made with his friends for a limited amount of money, and then you just kind of put it out there in a few theaters, and it seems like just one person just found it and says, hey, look, I'm going to add this to my video distribution site and just put it out there for the world to see and see if it crashes or burns. So it seems to me that we will never know when a movie will have cult status or not, because as we've been talking about, it could be several thousands of years before a movie gets to obtain a cult status. And then even more years, like you were talking about Blade Runner, before it gets recognized as being a classic movie. No one knows, but as long as the director has the passion behind it, why not? And I'm so grateful for studios like Severlight, Shout, Vestron. I'm trying to think. There's like another company that specializes in cult films for like video distribution, and I just can't think of it right now. But do you know what this is? My
no, but I mean, there's, you know, I mean, every film is going to have its own. This is why I was saying, like, every film is going to have its own path, and you got to look. It's each individual thing of what's success for that film, and then
exactly.
What's the so, you know, in the case of The Room, it had local notoriety and some curiosity, in, you know, and then I think some of it was also just the local press, like alternative magazines and stuff finding it, and early blogs and websites going like, this thing is weird and you should check it out, and then people getting copies. I mean, you know, the way you would get, you know, think of all the ways that people would get copies before the internet. They might, you know, they might get tapes of it or VHS tapes, and it gets passed around or it gets mailed out, you know, all that kind of stuff. There's certainly, you know, there are cult films even today where you can't get them. I'm trying to think, there's that are just hard to find, like Song of the South or Rad.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, you just can't go into a store and get a copy of those, and it's not really anywhere, but they have followings, and people, you know, people find it. I Was a Teenage Werewolf. I've been looking for that one for years.
Oh, God.
Cannot find it.
There is a station in my area, and it's called Comet. I love Comet TV. Comet TV has been playing a bunch of, like, older movies. They've been playing movies like My Mom is a Werewolf. And, gosh, I'm just kind of looking them up right now. But when you talked about that, it was like a sci-fi network, and they just only specialize in, like, they do, like, older episodes of MST3K, but they do, like, Thunderbirds. They're doing Strange Invaders. I think both the original and the remake. We call Unforgettable. Yeah, they just actually have a good listing of older movies. Alienator, Alien from L.A., Meteor Man. So I think networks like that are really kind of good of also bringing cult movies to a more of audiences today. I do want to get into your guys' thoughts about some underrated and overrated cult movies, but do any of you have any kind of like final thoughts about the nature of like what makes a cult movie, I guess, what makes a movie considered to be a cult movie today? Because this is kind of one of those topics there that, and plus, cult movies have like different genres, you know, there could be like cult dramas, and then cult thrillers and cult horror, but just kind of your general opinions about what you think makes a cult movie.
Well, like I said, I think it's just something that there's different definitions of a cult film, but the one I subscribe to is something that wasn't initially successful at the box office, yet, you know, over time, fans take it back. You know, they like it for whatever reason. And, you know, again, it's like a word of mouth of, you know, you got to see this film. You know, maybe it's so bad it's good. Maybe it's, you know, critics didn't like it, but I like it. You might like it. You know, pass it on kind of thing.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. I would broaden the bit that it's initially unsuccessful. So maybe it never even got distribution because it was made on a shoestring, and, you know, and then somebody discovers it, you know, and I'm thinking, you know, something along the lines like the way that like a Miami Connection got out there. You know, there are plenty of cult films that just never were released and then suddenly somebody finds it, and then it's word of mouth, and you got to check this thing out, and it's so wacky or whatever, you know. So there's that route too. So, but yeah, I would say that ultimately that it's fan base kind of takes it back and reclaims it.
We'll return after these announcements.
Hey, this is Adam Nutter.
And this is Greg Trout. Come check out our podcast, Nerds with Words. Adam and I talk about pop culture, comedy, comic books, movies, conspiracies. We're both comedians and we might make you laugh. Every week we welcome a guest from the entire spectrum of pop culture and science and comedy. You can follow us on Twitter at NerdsWithWords1.
This podcast is a proud member of the LAMB Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Hi everyone, this is Tim Costa.
I'm Hermano Da Silva.
And this is Walter Vinci.
And together we are the First Time Watchers Podcast.
Each week we choose a movie to review that none of us has seen.
Watch it together.
And then discuss.
These movies could be new.
Or old.
Or on our list of shame.
You can find us on iTunes by searching for the First Time Watchers Podcast.
As well as on Stitcher.
And we love interacting with our listeners, so if you have any suggestions, send us a tweet.
An email.
Or post to our Facebook page.
We'd love to hear from you.
That's right. I mean, it's all about interaction.
And talk about what we love, movies.
And you don't have to worry about us going on and on about this and that and the other. And oh,
no,
look,
no, no,
let's
no,
talk
stop,
about
stop,
this
stop,
minutiae
shut up,
here.
Shut up, shut up, shut
and
up,
I
shut up.
I wonder who the cat that can
God damn it, shut up!
I think that's enough, Walter.
My God, go by turn the credits.
All right, so I will ask you guys your thoughts about five underrated cult films and then five overrated cult films. If you can't think of five, that's fine. If you just want to just toss out just a few titles here, I'll start with you, Mike. You know, what do you think are some overrated cult films, movies that you think have been put into cult status when they really shouldn't be? And then five movies, your few movies that you think should be more of a cult status.
Well, I cover this in my book. It's an 80s slasher, but it really doesn't kind of get the love or the attention it should. It's The Final Terror from 1983.
There is nothing to be afraid of.
They wouldn't have left us up here all night if there wasn't something wrong.
Your friends aren't really missing. They're not really dead. This is just some kind of joke.
What the hell was that?
That thing that's out there, whatever it is, can't be real. It's just your imagination.
I swear I'm not dreaming! I'm not dreaming!
Or maybe, just this once, you're dead wrong. The legend is told in whispers, an unholy tale of an unknown force alien to this world.
You don't know what you're dealing with, lady.
Without knowing, they have awakened a terrifying evil.
We want to get out of here!
Alone and unprotected, now comes the naked horror. Final Terror.
And it's kind of amazing because it merges the survivalist horror and slasher together. And it's, you know, it's something that not a lot of 80s slashers were doing. And it's a really interesting movie, and it's got a really good cast of well-known people. Daryl Hannah's in it. Mark Metcalf. Just a lot of faces you would recognize. Actually, Scream Factory just put out a Blu-ray a few years ago.
Okay.
And yeah, it's very much worth checking out. Another one.
Wait, looking this up right now. It's from Andrew Davis, who directed The Fugitive.
Yeah.
And Under Siege. Okay. Oh, nice.
Yeah, like I said, it's a really neat, you know, slasher, because it's not just the usual formula. I like how they take the survivalist nature, that's a whole other subgenre, but they fuse it nicely, and it just works really well. And I think that the acting is actually above board. I mean, there was a scene where they discover a body, and the reactions from everybody feels really genuine, where it's not just like scream, oh no, like really insert really bad acting.
Sure.
So yeah, that's definitely one of those that is just painfully sorely underrated.
You got me interested in seeing this.
Yeah, like I said, it's readily available on Blu-ray. Scream Factory was awesome enough to put that out like 2 or 3 years ago.
They do really good job of actually making films not readily available, but really taking care and precision of cleaning up the print and giving us a good 5.1 stereo mix to it. So yeah.
Yeah, and like I said, it's very much worth checking out. And my other choice is, again, it's something I covered in my film guide. It's Dr. Caligari, but it's not to be confused with the silent film, because it really has nothing to do with that at all. But it's this really bizarre psychosexual art house film. That right there should just sell the film.
Is that the one from the 60s?
No, this was in 1989.
Oh, okay.
I recall the one you're talking about, but totally different. But what's kind of cool is they take the German expressionist style from the silent film. And all the sets are very visibly handmade, but that's kind of that's the purposeful charm of the movie. And like I said, the plot is just so crazy. And again, it's I think there's only a VHS, and I think the VHS is probably pretty expensive, but. It's a title that's worth seeking out. It's one of those movies from the 80s that kind of nobody talks about, and everybody should. But yeah, it's definitely also worth checking out.
I think he also did, the director of this also did a movie called Cafe Flesh back in the 80s. And then, yeah, he didn't really do much after that. Party Doll, Go-Go, Night Dreams 2... you're talking about the one for 1989, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. All right. Yeah. I didn't realize how many different versions there were of Dr. Caligari, and I am definitely interested in checking out this one. All right, any ones that you think that are overrated?
I don't get the appeal of Creep, the 2014 movie, or the sequel.
Oh yeah. Oh, the Duplass brothers, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, okay. I really liked the beginning, and I thought it had a really strong first and even second act. But then I thought, it turns a corner at a certain point, and then it just kind of lost me. And I thought the ending was, I thought it was rushed. I thought it was kind of slapped together. And I gave the sequel a chance, and again, the setup was strong, but it just really got muddled in the second and third act, where it was just, I thought it kind of ruined any of the momentum that it started with. But I mean, people love them, so I don't know. What do I know?
Is this the one with the? A bunch of them go out to the house, and there's a bag over the head, and they're. I'm trying to remember if I've seen those or not.
a guy answers an ad to record a documentary about this guy. So it's basically just one guy going to this guy's house. And then Mark Duplass plays the owner of the house. And he's wearing, like, this wolf mask. And he tries different ways to freak him out. And you're not quite sure what this guy is about. He just seems a little unhinged and kind of weird. But nothing too dangerous about him. And then I don't know if I want to give spoilers out here now. But I'm going to do spoilers here. He actually is a psychopath. But
I'm thinking of Baghead. Never mind. Okay. I was like, this kind of sounds familiar, and I thought it was okay. But didn't know there was a sequel. And okay.
Yeah.
It's a completely different film.
It's a found footage film. Just one guy with the camera, and I think by the time this came out, the whole found footage genre has just kind of died down, and I'm sure there are movies that do it well, but I'm kind of with Mike about this one. It was alright. It would have been fine as a short film, but not as a feature.
Yeah.
I did that there.
Real quick, just, you're talking about underrated, are you guys familiar with Tim Ritter's films at all?
Tim Ritter. I probably might be if I knew the names of some of them.
He did Killing Spree. He did, I guess Truth or Dare was probably his most well-known. Not the new one, but he did a film called Truth or Dare.
Madonna's Truth or Dare?
What's that?
Madonna's Truth or Dare? You talk about Madonna Truth or Dare?
No, this okay. is the 86.
Okay.
But, he did a movie called Creep as well from 1995, and it's kind of one of the best worst movies. I know that's the bold claim, but it's really something you have to see to believe. It's amazing.
Gotcha.
It's one of those amazing shot on video for literally nothing.
I'm looking this up right now, and I remember seeing the VHS of this, like, back when I was a kid, back to the video stores I visited, but I just never actually watched it. It was something that you kind of walk by, and you see the picture, like, and then you just couldn't go and grab it because you're afraid your parents are going to be right behind you.
Yeah, like Killing Spree, that's another one Tim Ritter did, and it's epic. It has one of my most favorite scenes from any movie, where the main character flips out because his wife made him pork chops. And there's a whole rant about the pork chops. And then moments later, there's a scene where he's vacuuming in Speedos, because why not? I'm trying to think, there was a company that just put out Blu-rays for both of those, so they're actually really easy to find.
Oh my gosh. All right, and look at this right now too. It looks like he has a movie, yeah, High Death.
Yeah.
Okay, that was funny as hell. All right, okay, very cool. Scott,
yes.
What do you think are some underrated and overrated cult films?
Oof, underrated. I could rattling some off that I kind of sketched some out before the show, and then as we were talking, like, other ones were coming to mind. So a bunch of these are coming out in no particular order. Some of them are heard of and recognizable, like Xanadu.
Open your eyes and hear the magic. Universal Pictures announces the most dazzling romantic musical fantasy in years. Xanadu. Starring Olivia Newton-John, Michael Beck, and Gene Kelly.
I'm alive, and the world turns for me today. I'm alive. Xanadu. It's a love story about a boy and girl from two very different worlds whom no one can keep apart. It's a spectacular entertainment that will transport you beyond your dreams. Xanadu, where time stops and the magic never ends. Xanadu.
I have an unjustified, inexplicable love of that film. I think maybe it was the only, growing up, it was the only movie my sisters and I could agree on, so it got played all the time. But,
holy shit, you too?
Yeah.
Damn.
We watch a lot of Xanadu and a lot of Grease too, which is, wow.
Yes.
Way inappropriate, but yeah, that's what, that was my childhood right there, apparently. It's, if you're not familiar with Xanadu, it's this weird mashup of roller skating and electric light orchestra and big bands, like trying to merge like big band with kind of a synth rock kind of thing. It's very, and Olivia Newton-John and the guy from the Warriors, yeah. and Gene Kelly, and they're all just kind of, it's,
Here's the basic plot for Xanadu. A artist is having a hard time designing album covers. Olivia Newton-John and a bunch of muses come down to help inspire him. This also inspires them to open up a roller skating dance club. Gene Kelly, there's other musical numbers. Don Bluth does an animated sequence, and yep. That's all we need to know.
It is objectively terrible.
Yes.
I love it. I cannot explain why. If you want something a little more classic, may I recommend The Giant Claw?
Ooh.
I've actually seen that.
Yes. It's kind of like an American kaiju movie, but if we replaced the monster with someone's papier-mâché vulture, it's very it's got all the hallmarks of this like Silver Age build up, and oh no, nuclear things are bad, and when they finally show them, like the story is that in its premiere, when they premiered the film, you know, they're building up to it, and they finally show the bird that has the giant claw. It's like a giant monster vulture bird. The audience broke out into laughter, and the star of the film immediately fled the theater because he was stupid. Yeah.
Gotcha.
What else? Okay. No Retreat, No Surrender. This is an 80s kind of following the wave and success of The Karate Kid, only replace the evil dojo with well, still an evil dojo, but also there's a New York mob trying to take over West Coast dojos, and there's apparently a big beef between Seattle and Los Angeles that I'm not aware of because I live on the East Coast, and instead of a Mr. Miyagi, our hero goes and summons the ghost of Bruce Lee to train him, and the ghost of Bruce Lee shows up as played by an Asian man who does not look like Bruce Lee at all. Which, just an insult to injury, is there's actually a moment in the film where he's standing next to a poster of Bruce Lee, and the main character is looking at the two, like, back and forth, like, oh, it's a person. And, like, no, it is objectively not the same person. So there's that. Along the same lines, there's Karate Dog, which, good grief. There is a dog, like, there's a dog. It's one of these, like, the dog buddy, like a cop buddies up with the dog and they fight, they solve a crime kind of film. Except in this one, the dog is voiced by Chevy Chase and is a kung fu master. So let that sink in. And so it's like CG, it's all the CGI dog on his hind legs, and of course, there's a Matrix moment, and my all. If there's one film that I will evangelize for to the end of my days. It's Deathstalker 2, now available on Amazon Prime for free streaming. Deathstalker 2 is a quasi-sequel to... Deathstalker 2 is basically the Evil Dead 2 to the original Deathstalker. They took the original Deathstalker, which is a sword and sandals, gritty, cheap barbarian film where it's like, oh, this guy lifts a lot of weights and she's posed in penthouse, so we'll just get some rubber masks and swords and make a movie. And it's, you know, they took that film and they re-edited parts of it and recast the role of Deathstalker as that really cool swarmy guy you went to high school with that was in all the shop classes. So everyone else is all trying to be like faux Shakespearean, and he's just like smirking his way through it with his feathered hair, and he's like, eh, can you believe this crap? Whatever, you know. And then you add in, like, you know, the unnecessary nudity and just random clips and stuff edited in from the previous movie. It is a beautiful, it's my favorite movie to drink to. Just there's like, it's a movie that was basically made to have a drinking game to. So those are all just underrated in my mind for cult films. Overrated, I'll be quicker. Repo Man, I never quite understood. There's moments that are wacky and moments, but I never got the real appeal to Repo Man. Chasing Amy, I never really understood. And maybe because I had a hard time understanding the main character's thoughts, like thought process, like he didn't make sense to me. I don't know. Killdozer, exclamation point, is a big disappointment. So don't bother. If you were like me, you went into Killdozer expecting a bulldozer just running wild and plowing people over. And no, he's running wild, but he's just more of a jerk, like inconveniencing people and stuff like that. That's a real bummer. And then I'm going to go with a blanket one. It's pretty much any movie that's been featured on Mystery Science Theater. I have Jason and I on the Lay of the Unwanted have made the mistake on numerous occasions of going like, oh yeah, let's go look at that film that was featured on Mystery Science Theater. And what you discover in a lot of cases is that without having, like, you know, Mike or Joel and the bots making comments throughout it, it's an unwatchable film. There's been a lot of movies I've been burnt by that one, like Monster a Go-Go and Robot Monster. And you go to try to watch it and you're like, oh, wait a minute. This is actively terrible. I don't want to be watching this. So that's I know I just blurred through a whole bunch of titles. I don't know if you have any thoughts one way or the other on any of those.
Despa, for sure.
Yeah.
And how can you not love an 80s spandexy, you know, killer robot movie? I mean, it's got a little bit of everything thrown in there.
In a way that I was not expecting. I thought it'd been enough to have somebody like a slasher in a that's in a gym or in a spa opposed to in a, you know, summer camp. But yeah, that movie gets really, really out there.
It throws everything at you, and it's such a mess, but it's a wonderful mess. Like, I could watch that anytime. That's kind of a perfect hangover movie.
Yeah. Have you seen this, Fern?
What
Death Spa.
Death Spa. Is that the sequel to Deathbed?
No.
No. I've not seen this one at all. See, my problem is that if it's not on Netflix, or I don't see it come up on Hulu, it's really difficult for me to know. Unless I see it on a feed somewhere.
Do you have Amazon Prime? Because it streams on Prime.
I do not have Amazon Prime because I don't feel like spending $100 a year. It's only $100 a year. That's not too bad. No, I only have Hulu and Netflix right now. But also, I have, like, Vudu, so if there's a movie I really want to see, I'll pay the $3 to watch it.
It may be on Vudu, and it may even be on, it's one of those films, it may even be on YouTube, just floating around out there, because people may not care enough.
Yeah,
you know?
But it's very much worth seeking out, because it's one of those just so bananas that it's hard for us to really give it to describe it accurately. You just have to see it.
Well, for me, I only have a few underrated movies, and I'm picking these because I don't know if there actually are Blu-ray copies of these, but I really kind of want to own this. One is Stepfather, Terrell Quinn movie. I saw it on VHS. I was never able to find a DVD copy of Stepfather, but I really want to see that. And another one is Popcorn.
Popcorn is one you're not going to find. That was a tough one. The Stepfather you may be able to find somewhere. That's another one you may actually find on YouTube somewhere.
Well, that for sure. Actually, Stepfather and the two sequels are all on Prime.
They are.
And Popcorn just got a really good Blu-ray, less than a year ago. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It did.
Synapse did a really nice steelbook Blu-ray, but I think they even have a regular Blu-ray edition that's inexpensive, so.
Really? Okay. I mean, I was trying to find an edition of Stepfather with, commentary or behind-the-scenes footage.
Oh, yeah. As far as Blu-ray of Stepfathers, I don't think there is. I mean, correct. I mean, I might be wrong, but I'm pretty sure there's. Like I said, I know that the three films are streaming, but as far as a physical media copy, I don't think.
All right, as far as overrated, I'm not saying these are a bad movie, but I never got the whole cult status of Primer. One of those I just never really got into right there.
And I kind of get that. It's very slow, and you really need to be. It's one of those films that you need to really watch it and think about it and watch it again and think about it, and if you're into time travel, because I know Jason Soto loves time travel, and he's watched that a bunch of times and gets really into it. He's made the maps of to make sure that it, you know, that's how the things flowed and stuff. But that I could see that being a love it or hate it kind of film.
And also, I like the sci-fi movies, the sci-fi originals, because I think they're just making them mainly just silly. And that's the only reason why they're successful, is because they're just going for the comedy aspect right away. It's a movie that's bad, but it's trying to be bad.
Right, and this is something we touched on earlier, yes, you can make an intentionally bad movie and have it be funny, enjoyable, and all that, but it is tricky. It's really hard to thread that needle, because for every Sharknado, you're going to get,
Sharktopus versus,
right, yeah, or it's Sharktopus versus giant piranha or whatever. I mean, they crank things like that out all the time, and they're not good. So
other ones would be Harold and Maude. I don't really get the whole cult status of Harold and Maude.
Oh, that's such a great film, though.
I have already seen that one. I don't know. I don't know.
Okay. But I want to mention that those first two, the Popcorn and Stepfather, because those are movies I actually want to get a good Blu-ray release for, and just have not been able to find this at all.
I said, Popcorn is if you go on their website, I'm pretty sure that they might even still have the steelbook. But if you're looking for just a regular Blu-ray, I think they have a non-steelbook, just regular. I think it's $20 maybe. And right. Synapse, their stuff is usually really on point. So.
All right, Very cool. Well, listen to this, folks. We're gonna take a quick break, play some ads from some other great podcast shows, and then do you guys feel comfortable with playing a quick trivia game?
Sure.
Don't expect me to do well, but sure.
Okay, all right, we'll be back.
We'll return after these messages.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
Is another apocalyptical prediction about to come true? Winds of death sweep across the world, and whole continents will be cast adrift in an ocean of blood.
Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, action, exploitation, kung fu, and women in prison movies from the 1970s to today. Be sure and check out reallyawfulmovies.com for reviews, interviews, lists, and terrific movie giveaways.
I am a movie critic by trade, and until recently, I got paid to tell you people which movies merely stink and which ones you shouldn't screen near an open flame. Well, I'm putting the burden of lousy movies back on you. It's very simple. If you stop going to bad movies, they'll stop making bad movies.
Uh-oh. The jig is up.
And we are back, everybody. Thank you for sticking with us for the Cinema Recall Podcast over at ThatMomentIn.com. Big thanks again to our guest, Mike Vaughn. Mike, really quickly, though, before we get going with our trivia... can you tell the listeners where we can find you? I mean, where can we check out this your book and, you know, other stuff you do? Where can we find you,
Mike? I'm on Twitter, at StrangeCinema65. And I'm also on Facebook, just Mike Vaughn. So, hit me up.
And give us the very title cool. of the book again.
Yeah, so it's The Ultimate Guide to Strange Cinema. It features over 300 reviews, but not just reviews, but I also have interviews with some of the actors or film, filmmakers. It's a trivia. I do like a movie pairings where, this movie. Might go well with this movie or this movie if you want to make it like a double or triple feature. So
very cool.
Yeah, so it kind of has some cool features. Some of the trivia, I've reached out to some of the filmmakers and they actually gave me some of the trivia. It's not all just recycled from IMDb. And like I said, I have some really great interviews. Like, are you guys familiar with Student Bodies?
Yep.
Yeah.
So this is so awesome. I'm so proud of this. So Joe Flood, who plays Mr. Dumpkins, you know, the horse head guy.
Yep.
So I got a hold of him, and he was cool enough to give me an interview, and it's in the book.
Nice.
Very cool.
So, you know, I try to make it not just, you know, here's my opinions on movies. I try to make it... You know, go the step further, track some people down for interviews, do some cool trivia. And I dug up a lot of really weird, obscure stuff. So I feel like even hardcore fans might find something they haven't, you know, seen or even heard of. One of the titles is Devil Fetus. Are you guys familiar with this?
What's it called?
Devil Fetus.
Devil Fetus.
I've heard of it, but I haven't seen it.
Yeah, it's a... Well, I mean, of course, it's a properly strange 80s film from Hong Kong, and it's... Well, I mean, the title says it all. It's... I mean, it's just one of those... I could describe it to you, but you would just have to see it. But yeah, I mean, so like I have a lot of underground stuff, like Nick Zed, you know. But then I also have like Jean-Luc Godard or, you know, John Waters, stuff that people might be a little bit more familiar with, you know. So it's like sleazy, alongside like highbrow. So it's weird mixture. But you know, I mean, again, the one unifying factor is it's all really strange or weird or unusual. So
very cool, Scott, buddy. Tell the listeners out there where they can find you and your book and anything you want to plug.
Oh, absolutely. So you can hear my dulcet tones every month at The Layer of the Unwanted, which I co-host with Jason Soto. That's over at www.thelayeroftheunwanted.com, where we cover bad movies because we hate ourselves or whatever, and we've been doing that for about 9 years. We're into our 9th year doing that, so you can always find me there. I don't tweet, so there's that. But you can find my book, The Bargain Bin Review, and under the author named Scott Nolan, and that is I'm lazier than Mike, so there is 90 reviews in there. Also in there, I just to make things a little different and interesting, I have these kind of interstitial pieces there that are autobiographical. It's basically my road to bad movies, which ultimately kind of answers the question, why bad movies, which I get all the time. So that's kind of a fun, neat angle in there. So go check that out. You can get that at Ye Old Amazon. Otherwise, you can go to my new blog, as I am beginning to transition to a whole different style and genre of writing. Over and kind of like a butterfly coming out of the cocoon, and that you can find at House of Nolan, which you can find at House of Nolan, that's NOLAHN, at blogspot.com, where I am talking about the project that I've been working on for the last 2 years now, so which is not movie related at all, so I won't go into all that much detail here. So,
all right, very cool. All right, gentlemen, are you ready to play a game?
Oh, sounds sure.
Good.
All right, now I'm going to ask you this: what genre do you want to go with? Fantasy, horror, or comedy?
Do we have to pick the same genre?
Yes. So, did you guys do agree on a genre?
We gotta do an aside here. What do you think? I always feel like horror goes really deep, and it's gonna be, you know, like really deep into the horror. And I'm a bad movie guy, but I'm not a horror guy. I've always kind of left the horror heavy lifting to Jason Soto. What do you think? Maybe fantasy?
Yeah, that sounds good.
Comedy?
Fantasy sounds good.
All right, we would like to take fantasy, please, Vern.
Okay, so fantasy, all right, give me just one second here while I load this up. Okay, so, come on, where are you?
And are we going head-to-head? Are we working collaboratively?
Yes.
What's going on?
Yep, no,
okay.
You're going to work head-to-head here. All right, I'm actually going to do the movie Labyrinth. Because that's what came up on my random trivia generator.
Okay.
Your first question is,
are we fighting over, like, we just yell out
yes,
our names?
Yes, yeah. Okay, so you each say your name when you know the answer, okay? All right. So, who is tasked with giving Sarah the poisoned peach?
Mike here, Hoggle.
Mike. Ding, 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 Mike. 1 point for Mike here. All right. So right now, all right.
Were we starting with, like, the easy question? Is that...
Oh, there's three rounds. There's three rounds to this,
okay.
All right.
I was like, oh, boy. All right. Here we go.
All right.
Question two.
Okay, all right. What is... Actually, no, there's only one round. What is the name of the wetland in the Labyrinth?
Scott.
Scott.
It's the stink.
Now can I chime in?
You didn't steal. If he doesn't know it, you didn't jump in and steal. But I'll give like a sky countdown of 5.
Stinklands.
4.
Stinky.
3.
Pit.
2.
Butt stink.
1.
All right,
Mike.
The Bog of Eternal Stench.
That's 2 for Mike. Very good. All right. Nice. Very good. All right. All right. What is the name of the place where the Helping Hands drop Sarah? Anybody?
I'm not sure.
No.
No, it's a guess.
I remember that there was a bog, and it was stinky from the last question.
All right. It was called the Obelette.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wait, what was it called? Hold on. What was it called again?
The Obelisk.
If I were to put together random syllables, I would have never come up with that.
That's what it says here, okay? All right. Who is Domitius? And you just tell me what type of animal he is.
He's a Scott. No,
oh,
that's
Scott,
not, that's
go
not
ahead.
My answer. I'm chiming in. I'm ringing in. He's a dog.
Okay. Yes!
Sweet.
Right, so Scott now is on the board with 1. All right. All right. Okay. Now, what does Jareth offer Sarah in exchange for her little brother Toby?
Scott.
Okay, Scott.
He offers her heart's desire.
Do you want to hear your list of choices here?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. So we have Queen Hood,
uh-huh.
A crystal ball, fame or fortune.
That was fame or fortune.
Is that your answer? I know, those are two separate answers. Fame.
Oh, crap. All right, fame.
Incorrect.
The crystal ball?
Crystal ball. Yes! Mike, 3 on the board there. All right. Kunis. All right. Who said, "Hey, lady, where are you going with a head like that?"
Scott.
Scott.
Is it Hoggle?
No.
I'm trying to think. I can picture the characters, but I don't recall what they're called.
It will kind of do your best description of it, though, and then...
They're like... they're like bird things. Can we get multiple choice?
I don't have really multiple choices for this one. I'm sorry, no.
Not sure.
Okay. Do you describe anything they do, or... All right. There's a lot of other bird creatures there, so okay. If you don't know here, okay, well, it was called the Fieries, and I guess the best way to describe it is that they're the ones with the sequence where they're taking their heads off each other and throwing it back and forth.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, okay. No points on that one here, that's alright. What does Sarah try to use... Well, sorry, let me repeat this. What does Sarah try to use to mark her path through the labyrinth, and I've got like 4 choices here. Is it sand, string, lipstick, or chalk?
Mike, chalk.
Mike. Incorrect.
Scott. I think it's lipstick.
Scott. Yes. Scott on the board there. All right.
I was gonna guess chalk too. So it's, so thank you.
All right. What is the peach that Jareth orders Hoggle to give to Sarah supposed to do? And there's some choices here. Kill her. Make her fall in love with Jareth. Make her forget everything. Or put her to sleep.
Scott. Mike. Oh, go ahead.
Scott, well, I think it might be the first there.
Mike. Make her forget.
Correct. Ooh, that was a tie game now.
Wait, how is it a tie game?
No, sorry. Sorry, never mind. I might a little ahead there. Sorry about that. No. All right. My mistake there.
Unless I'm suddenly really bad at counting.
No. Actually, it's throw update here by Jeff 4, Scott Jeff 2. All right. Which of these four scenes... I made a mistake there. That's not what I want to do. All right. Sorry. Wrong question. Sorry about that. What world does Hoggle use to describe the labyrinth to Sarah? Did he say scary, cozy, ugly, or beautiful?
And what's he describing again?
Okay, let me repeat this. What word does Hoggle use to describe the labyrinth to Sarah? Scary, cozy, ugly, beautiful.
Scott. I'm going to go with cozy.
You say cozy. Yes! Good job. All right. But still, I think Mike is the winner for this particular round. So good job, Mike. All right. But why not? Let's do one more round here. You want to do comedy or horror?
Let's do horror.
Let's do this. We're going to do the movies. Can I just put that random here? We're going to do the original Friday the 13th, all right? The movie opens at Camp Crystal Lake in what year? And their choices here, we have 1958, 1964, 1970, or 1975.
Mike, 1958.
Mike. Correct. Right. What is Camp Crystal Lake commonly referred to as by the locals? And here are your choices. The Slaughterhouse, Camp Fear, Camp Blood, or Devil's Snare?
Scott. Camp Blood.
Correct.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So we have one for Mike, one for Scott. All right. Nice job.
I've never seen this film, so. I'm pulling stuff.
Really?
Out of
okay. All right. So far, so good. All right. Grand Blood. All right. Very good. All right. All right. Who is Annie?
Mike. She's supposed to be the cook.
Do you know the actress' name?
No. I thought you meant, who is she in the movie?
Oh, the cook, okay. All right, yeah. Correct, all right. Miss Voorhees kills her victims in the fallen ways, except for how? And I have your choices here.
And this is a way that she did not kill someone. Yes, okay.
Yeah. Miss Voorhees kills her victims in all the fallen ways, except for, so we have a knife to the throat, axe to the face, arrow through the neck, chainsaw to the stomach.
Mike, chainsaw.
Mike. Very good. All right. So Mike, right there. Hold on here. I'm just updating the scores here. All right. What was Mrs. Voorhees' job at the camp when she worked there? And there's choices here. Cook, nurse, lifeguard, counselor.
Mike, she was a cook.
Mike. Yep. Very good. when was Camp Crystal Lake established? Was it 57, 1980, 1896, 1935?
Scott. 1935.
Correct.
Really?
Yep.
Okay.
Good job, man. Yeah. All right. How does the killer murder Annie? Is it stabs her in the heart, strangles her, cuts her throat, or disembowels her?
Mike, cuts her throat.
Correct. All right. Let's see now. All right. All right. What game does Brenda get the others to play with her? Is it Adult's Charade, Never Have I Ever, Fuck, Marry, Kill, Strip Monopoly?
Mike, Strip Monopoly.
Mike. Strip Monopoly. What the hell? All right. All right. Nice. And the last one here. What color raincoats do we not... I'm sorry. This is weird. What color raincoats do we not... What color raincoat does not a counselor wear during the storm? This is how it's written on here. What color raincoats do we not a counselor wear during the storm? But here are the choices: yellow, orange, purple, or green.
Mike, I'm going to say purple.
Purple? Correct. All right. Well, in both games right there, Mike is the winner for both of them right there. So, Mike, this is your opportunity right now to just kind of like any new upcoming projects you're working on. I know you're still, you wrote this big book, but anything new come up here? Anything, any other podcast you're appearing on? Go ahead and plug away, man.
As far as projects go, I have two proposals into my. Publisher, so kind of have to wait and see. I'm actually kind of toying around with the idea of maybe doing a volume 2 of the film guide eventually. That might not be for a little while because as much as I loved writing this, it was a lot of work, a lot of time, actually a lot of just some of my own money put into it. So it was kind of crazy for our first project, but, you know, I enjoy doing it, but, you know, I'm actually kind of getting into the idea of maybe doing another one. And, you know, people seem to be liking it. So, as far as, anything else that's kind of, you know, that's kind of it, for me.
Okay, very cool. And then Scott, anything you want to plug? Any appearances on podcasts or new book ideas or anything? Plug away,
just what I talked about before. You know, you could always listen to me on The Layer of the Unwanted, available on all free podcasting platforms and like iTunes and all that kind of goodness. Or you can go over to www.thelayerofTheUnwanted.com. You can buy my book over on which is The Bargain Bin Review over at Amazon, or you can check out my current blog, House of Nolan, at blogspot.com, where I talk about upcoming the project that I've been kind of working on. I'm transitioning from, you know, spending the last about decade writing these short reviews of, you know, short form kind of nonfiction reviews of bad movies, and kind of transitioning over to long form fiction as I'm writing a novel. So,
all right.
Yeah, it's been an adjustment. So,
like it's all
as
right.
You could imagine, and of course it's kind of like it's like a mystery slash thriller. So then it's like that extra degree of difficulty. I couldn't just write some, you know, whatever. It's got to be like, you know, clues and stuff like that. So it's been, so I just, the blog itself is about that entire process, but I still, you know, I will put up a bad movie of the month just for fun. I actually just featured Body Rock on there as the bad movie of the month. So, which,
gosh,
have either of you seen
or heard of Body Rock? Never heard of this movie.
I've heard of this. I have not seen it yet.
It is stunningly bad. It's it stars a very young Lorenzo Lamas, and he is the manager of a breakdancing crew, and it's his rise and fall, which I find very interesting because he's not the one doing anything, yet he's the one that gets really famous. It's one of the things that's really kind of hard to wrap your head around, is that he's the, like, everyone else in the crew, like, they're the ones who can actually dance, and he just, like, hangs out in a long leather duster, and he's Lorenzo Lamas, you know.
So. Oh, buddy. Oh, very cool. What I can, big thank you for both being here. Yes, everybody. Well, check out the books. I really enjoyed this conversation. You guys both gave me some really great movies to seek out. So I really enjoyed that. I enjoyed each of your thoughts and opinions about what makes a cult film, your underrated and overrated films as well. As for the Cinema Recall podcast, our next episode will be on the movie Charlie's Angels. Our guest will be Damien Riley from the Damien Riley podcast and Talking Stars. We're going to talk about a few movies there. We had a poll about best TV movie adaptation, and Charlie's Angels got the most votes, so that's what's going to be talked about. And then after that episode, I think our next big show that is going to be made, and it won't be released until October, we're going to be doing a audio drama of Ghostbusters. Very excited about that. I will give you more details about that on our next episode. But as always, you can listen to us through Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher Radio. Just type in the name that opens in. We are on a podcast network with other great shows such as TV Good, Sleep Bad, Asian Cinema Film Club, and Game Warp. So very excited. I guess another news too is that we're going to start doing weekly box office report episodes, so look for that sometime in the next week or so. But yeah, we're like on Twitter, just type in at Cinema Recall. Our website, like I said before, is thatmomentin.com. Facebook, just type in Cinema Recall. I'm the Vern, saying again thank you to my guest Scott Nolan, who wrote the book Bargain Bin Reviews, and Mike Vaughn, who wrote The Ultimate Guide to Strange Cinema. If you go onto our website, there'll be links to buy each of their books. I highly recommend that you do, and I will say good night for now, unless you guys have anything else to say to the audiences before we leave.
Yeah, I'm pretty done. I think I'm ready for a nap.
All right. So. All right. Good night, everybody.